Hello, and welcome to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. As a true crime addict, I've binge listened to Sword and Scale, Generation Y, The Vanished, The Apex, and The Abyss, pretty much every single true crime podcast there is out there, True Murder. I've listened to it. What these shows have all left me with is just a craving to have more. So I set out to start my own podcast with the hopes that I could share my knowledge and passion for true crime and even learn something from you, the audience, and other true crime podcasters. Okay, that's enough. On to the show. Explicit content is found in this episode, so listener discretion is advised. November 1934. Attention, Delia Flanagan, Bud. My dear Mrs. Bud, in 1894, a friend of mine shipped as a deckhand on the steamer Tacoma, Captain John Davis, sailed from San Francisco to Hong Kong, China. On arriving there, he and two others went ashore and got drunk. When they returned, the boat was gone. At that time, there was a famine in China. Meat of any kind was $1 to $3 a pound. So great was the suffering among the very poor that all children under 12 were sold for food in order to keep others from starving. A boy or girl under 14 was not safe in the city. You could go in any shop and ask for steak, chops, or stew meat. Part of the naked body of a boy or girl would be brought out, and just what you wanted cut from it. A boy or girl's behind, which is the sweetest part of the body, and is sold as veal cutlets, brings the highest price. John stayed there so long that he acquired a taste for human flesh. On his return to New York, he stole two boys, 1 7, 1 11. He took them to his home, stripped them naked, and tied them up in a closet, and then burned everything they had on. Several times every day and night, he spanked them, tortured them, to make their meat good and tender. First, he killed the 11-year-old boy, because he had the fattest ass, and of course the most meat on it. Every part of his body was cooked and eaten, except the head, bones, and guts. He was roasted in the oven, all of his ass boiled, broiled, fried, and stewed. The little boy was next, and he went the same way. At that time, I was living at 409 East 100th Street. He told me so often how good human flesh was, and I made up my mind to taste it. On June 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street and brought you pot cheese and strawberries. We had lunch. Gray sat on my lap and kissed me. I made up my mind to eat her. On the pretense of taking her to a party, you said yes, she could go. I took her to an empty house in Westchester I had already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside. She picked wildflowers. I went upstairs and stripped all my clothes off. I knew if I did not, I would get her blood on them. When all was ready, I went to the window and called her. Then I hid in the closet until she was in the room. When she saw me all naked, she began to cry and tried to run down the stairs. I grabbed her, and she said she would tell her mama. First, I stripped her naked. How she did kick, bite, and scratch. I choked her to death. Then cut her in small pieces so I could take the meat to my rooms, cook, and eat it. How sweet and tender her little ass was roasted in the oven. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body. I did not fuck her, though I could have if I wished. She died a virgin. Hamilton Howard Fish was born in 1870 to Randall and Eileen Fish. Randall Fish was 75 at the time of his birth and would pass 5 years later. In 1875, his mother, who often suffered from auditory and visual hallucinations, would turn him over to an orphanage due to being unable to care for him. Hamilton was relentlessly teased and bullied and earned the nickname Ham and Eggs. He changed his name to Albert to commemorate a dead sibling and to escape the dreaded nickname of Ham and Eggs. He was noted to be a problem child because of his multiple attempts at running away from the orphanage. This would lead to severe beatings and mistreatment at the hands of the staff. However, it was during these beatings that Albert began to experience pain in a different way. He began to experience pleasure when he was struck. The children who were witness to the results of his pleasure began teasing him even more. And in 1880, his mother retrieved him from the orphanage. In 1882, at the age of 12, Albert began to have a sexual relationship with another boy who worked delivering telegraphs. And it was through this boy that he would gain a fetish for urophilia and coprophilia, which means Albert became aroused when drinking urine and eating feces, or watching others do the same. In 1890, when Albert was 20, he moved from his hometown of Washington, D.C. to New York. It was then that he began moonlighting as a prostitute and quenching his pedophilic tendencies by raping and molesting young boys. It was said that Albert chose poor neighborhoods to kidnap, rape, molest, and eventually murder young boys from because the families were too poor to pay for ransoms, and as Albert would later add, they would not be missed. These boys would never be found, and it is unknown how many Albert may have actually killed or harmed during this time, if any. In 1898, he entered an arranged marriage that would later produce 6 children. The marriage would end in 1917 when his wife left him for another handyman. Albert discovered that the lover of his wife had been living in their attic for some time, and after a fight, his wife and her new lover left for good. It was during this time that Albert began to escalate in his behavior. His children would note in court testimony that he began asking them and other neighbor children for bare-bottom spankings from a nail-lined paddle. Albert didn't stop there with the self-harm. He would begin inserting needles into his pelvic region, urethra, and underneath his fingernails. He would also shove alcohol-soaked cotton balls into his anus and attempt to light them on fire. He began obsessing over consuming raw meat, and his devotion to God increased, so did his self-harm. God began commanding Albert to torture and castrate young boys, and as a faithful servant, Albert would oblige.
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Albert would be released from Sing Sing Prison at the age of 40 after serving a term for grand larceny and embezzlement. Upon his release, he would attack 2 young men. One, a mentally challenged boy, who he would torture, mutilate, attempt to castrate, and eventually murder. He then made his way to Delaware, where he would attack a young man by the name of Thomas Bedden. Not much is known about this young African-American male, other than Albert confessing to have harmed him. Older members of the Wilmington Police Department, when questioned in March of 1935, stated that they could not recall such a case. However, it should be noted that crimes against African Americans, even deaths of African Americans during 1910, were often not investigated by police or reported in the local newspapers. Albert would continue to display erratic and dangerous behavior. This behavior caused enough concern to have him committed to Bellevue Mental Hospital by his family. However, he would later be released with his file noting, disturbed but sane. In 1924, Albert attempted to abduct 8-year-old Patrice Keel by offering her money for assistance in searching for rhubarb. Patrice's mother prevented the abduction by chasing Albert away. Relentless, he returned later to sleep in their barn. And when Patrice's father, Hans, discovered him, he demanded that he leave immediately. Undeterred, Albert would try again on another young victim, Francis McDonald of Staten Island. On July 14, 1924, young Francis McDonald was lured from his porch while playing with his friends. His mother would later report that an old man was seen walking up and down their sidewalk, clenching and unclenching his fist while mumbling to himself. Francis's body would be found in some nearby woods. He was sexually assaulted and strangled with his own suspenders. It should be noted that Francis's father was a police officer. 1 month later, John Iskowski would be cornered by policemen and 50 armed citizens. Many of them were men whose sons had been molested. This hermit would be singled out for enticing small boys into his hut. John, while under a citizen's arrest, attempted to escape into nearby woods, where after being shot 4 times in the abdomen, would attempt to commit suicide by shooting himself in the head. In a New York Times article published August 18, 1924, it stated that detectives weren't able to find anything that appeared to directly connect him with the McDonald crime, except that his habits were those of a man who committed that murder. John was only able to utter Iskowski and Philadelphia, none of which assisted the officers, quote, fit Iskowski into the known circumstances of the McDonald crime and endeavoring to learn whether he had offered violence to any boy. The crime would remain unsolved until Albert's later confession. 4-year-old William Gaffney of Brooklyn, New York, was playing in the hallway outside of his apartment with his friend Billy Beaton on February 11, 1927. Both of the boys would be lured away by a strange boogeyman. Billy would later be found on the rooftop of that apartment building, where he would recount the story of how the boogeyman took William. Less than an hour after William went missing, a young boy and an older man, looking to be about age 50, would board the Hamilton Avenue trolley, where the older man would ask the conductor for directions to Staten Island. The trolley line ran only a few blocks from the Gaffney home. A motorman of the Fifth Avenue trolley station, Joseph Olson, recalled both the man and boy since there were only 2 other passengers on the car. The boy appeared to be upset and was not wearing a jacket despite the temperature outside. When the train came to its stop, the man dragged him off. WNYC would broadcast the description of the kidnapper as a man to be about 50 years old, 5 feet 8 inches tall, weighing 180 pounds, of dark complexion with a mustache. Brooklyn detectives would then comb through the Italian colony in the vicinity of Columbia and Van Brunt Streets. A search of all the stores and apartments left the police empty-handed. Gaffney's body would never be recovered. Although Grace Budd was not to be Fish's final victim, she was his most notable. On May 25th, 1928, Edward Budd Jr. would place an ad in the New York World Telegram that would seal his sister's fate. The ad read as follows. Young man, 18, wishes position in country. Edward Budd, 406 West 15th Street. A man by the name of Frank Howard would answer the ad and planned a visit to the Budd apartment. The first visit, Frank offered pot cheese, strawberries, and dollar bills to the young children. He was amiable and well-mannered and left the Budd family with a positive impression. He offered Edward and his friend Willie $15 a week to work on his farm. He stated that he needed the help very badly as his wife recently abandoned him and his 6 children. The Budds were ecstatic to potentially have the extra income, and Edward readily accepted his offer of employment. Frank stated that he would return in a few days to pick up Edward and Willie. On June 2nd, Frank sent a Western Union telegram expressing his apologies for not being able to make it out that day. However, he would be by the next day to pick up his new employees. June 3rd arrived, and Frank was again welcomed into the Budd home. He conversed with the family about the farm and Edward's daily job duties. He then made mention of his niece's birthday party. He invited Edward's younger sister, Grace, to the party and promised to return her the same evening once the party was over. The Buds agreed. Although Delia was hesitant, she was so impressed with Frank's manners that she humored her daughter and her husband and allowed her to accompany Mr. Howard. I'll read you the transcript from his trial so that you can get a clear picture of what occurred that day. So, she left home, that little flat, on Sunday afternoon, shortly after the noon hour with this defendant, and her parents have never seen or heard from her since. A report was made the next day to the police station that Grace had gone away and had not returned. The police department assigned a detective to this case, and an investigation was made into her whereabouts. On or about the 11th day of November, 1934, a letter was received at the Budd apartment. This letter was written by the defendant. It was unsigned. It was addressed to Miss Delia Budd. Now, the detective got that letter, and he followed it through. Frank Howard was able to be traced by the envelope he used to send that demented letter. The emblem that was found to be on the envelope read NYPCBA, which at the time stood for the New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association. When police arrived to the location, a worker admitted to taking some of the stationery to his rooming house, located on 200 East 52nd Street. They arrived at the rooming house and questioned the landlady. She soon divulged that they had just missed Albert by a few days. Not to be deterred by this revelation, they continued to get a description of the man once known as Frank Howard. The landlady offered that Albert's son had sent him some money and asked her to hold the check for Albert upon his return. That indicated to the investigator that Albert would be due back very soon. So the chief investigator opted to wait outside of the rooming house until Albert arrived. Once Albert arrived, he was quickly apprehended. During this apprehension, Fish agreed to go to the police headquarters to answer questions related to the disappearance of Grace Budd. After he agreed, he was walking to the police car when he pulled a razor blade from his pocket. Officers, unsure if he was attempting to bring harm upon himself or them, removed it from his possession. He was then taken to the station without further incident. Continuing with the court testimony. At police headquarters, this defendant stated that on the third day of June 1928, he left his bundle in which was a cleaver, a butcher's cleaver, a knife, and a saw at a newspaper stand on the corner before going to the Budd flat. After he had taken Grace under his pretense of going to his sister's children's birthday party, he picked up this bundle, which consisted of tools wrapped in canvas. Then he took the elevated and finally took the New York Central to the town of Greenburg. Grace was with him at the time. He got off the train and made his way to what is commonly known as Wisteria Cottage. He says that he took her in the room and choked her to death, and that it took about 5 minutes to do it. He knew that she was dead. Then he says he took her clothes off and cut her head off. Then he cut her across the body above the navel, he says, and left the lower part of her body and the torso behind the back door in the room. He took the head out to the outdoor toilet and back of the house and covered it with paper. 3 or 4 days later, he says, he came back to this particular house and took the various parts of her body, 3 in number, and threw them over the stone wall, which is at the back of the house. The trial of Albert Fish began on March 11th, 1935, and would last until the 21st. 3 of 6 children would testify on the strange acts of their father over a period of 20 years. His granddaughter would also testify, recounting a story of when she came in from inside and saw her grandfather hitting himself with a stick. It was instances over a long period of time that let his children know that all was not right with their dad. Albert confessed to Grace's murder 6 times, recounting a particularly chilling moment of when Delia initially objected to Albert taking Grace. Her father had said, "She didn't see much good times anyway. Let her go." He later added, "I didn't have any intention of killing the girl, but I was suddenly overcome with a certain bloodthirst. I meant to use those tools on her brother." He stated that after confessing, his conscience felt much better. The bones of Grace Budd would be found when Albert took detectives back to the homestead. Due to the level of decomposition, she could only be identified by dental records. Fish would be sentenced to death via the electric chair. He would occasionally, while in custody, slash the cross into his abdomen and would need surgery to repair the damage. It was then that an x-ray of his lower body would be taken. Albert's stomach and pelvis region would reveal an estimated blend of 29 pins and needles that he had swallowed or inserted into himself. I really can't make this stuff up. You can Google it and find the x-ray. Albert would go on to confess to the murder of William Billy Gaffney in a letter to his attorney stating, "I brought him to the Riker Avenue dumps. There is a house that stands alone, not far from where I took him. I took the boy there, stripped him naked, and tied his hands and feet, and gagged him with a piece of dirty rag I picked out of the dump. Then I burned his clothes, threw his shoes in the dump. Then I walked back and took the trolley to 59th Street at 2 a.m., and walked from there home. Next day, about 2 p.m., I took tools, a good heavy cat of nine tails, homemade, short handle, cut one of my belts in half, slit these halves in six strips about 8 inches long. I whipped his bare behind till the blood ran from his legs. I cut off his ears, nose, slit his mouth from ear to ear, gouged out his eyes. He was dead then. I stuck the knife in his belly and held my mouth to his body and drank his blood. I picked up four old potato sacks and gathered a pile of stones. Then I cut him up. I had a grip with me. I put his nose, ears, and a few slices of his belly in the grip. Then I cut him through the middle of his body, just below the belly button. Then, through his legs about 2 inches below his behind. I put this in my grip with a lot of paper. I cut off the head, feet, arms, hands, and the legs below the knee. This I put into sacks weighed with stones, tied the ends, and threw them in the pools of slimy water you will see along the road going North Beach. I came home with my meat. I had the front of his body I liked best. His monkey and peewees and a nice little fat behind to roast in the oven and eat. I made a stew out of his ears, nose, pieces of his face and belly. I put onions, carrots, turnips, celery, salt, and pepper. It was good. Then I split the cheeks of his behind open, cut off his monkey and peewees and washed them first. I put strips of bacon on each cheek of his behind and put them in the oven. Then I picked four onions, and when the meat had roasted about a quarter of an hour, I poured about a pint of water over it for gravy and put it in the onions. At frequent intervals, I basted his behind with a wooden spoon, so the meat would be nice and juicy. In about 2 hours, it was nice and browned, cooked through. I never ate any roast turkey that tasted half as good as his sweet, fat little behind did. I ate every bit of the meat in about 4 days. His little monkey was as sweet as a nut, but his peewees I could not chew, threw them in the toilet. I will admit that the motorman who positively identified me as getting off his car with a small boy was correct. I can tell you at the time, I was looking for a suitable place to do the job. Francis McDonald's murderer was identified by an 18-year-old Patrice Keel. She, her mother, and her father positively identified Albert Fish as the man who attempted to lure her away that day. Albert later confessed to being in the area at the time Francis was abducted and murdered. He would be indicted for the murder on February 20th, 1935. He was to be put to death at Sing Sing Prison on January 16, 1936. It would only be a few days prior to his execution that he would confess to the murders of Billy Gaffney and Francis McDonald in a letter to his attorney. His terror finally reached its end. Thank you for listening to the first episode of the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I may change the format up a little bit next episode, and I definitely would enjoy some feedback. You can find me on most social media platforms, Facebook under True Crime Fan Club Podcast, Twitter at TCFCPod, and of course on TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Please be sure to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It would really help me out. And if you have any suggestions for future episodes, I definitely want to hear from you. You can reach out to me at tcfcpod@gmail.com. Thanks again, and I'll see you in a few weeks.